Hello and welcome to Lost Steps with me, Malcolm Hopkins, coming to you courtesy of Resonance FM. If you've missed any of our previous programmes or want any background information on this or any of our other programmes, please access our website, loststeps.org. This is the second of four programmes that we're doing on Brixton, and today I'm pleased to welcome the writer Alex Wheatle. Welcome to Lost Steps, Alex.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, can I ask you to talk briefly about your early life? Were you born in Brixton?
Yes, I was born in Brixton, but because of family problems, I found myself in a children's home in the Surrey countryside. Because in those days, Lambeth used to send their children out because they didn't have enough room in a borough. And so from 3 years old, I was surrounded by fields, trees, bushes, what have you. And so I grew up with a kind of a Surrey middle-class mentality, even though it was very repressive and very violent at times. And because of my schooling problems, I was expelled three times from schools up to the age of 14. It was decided by the social workers that I returned to Brixton. And I remember not even knowing where Brixton was, because that was so far removed from my everyday existence. And so when I came to Brixton, what really alarmed me was I saw grown-up black people for the first time. I looked out the window and said to my social worker, could that be my dad or my mum? And when I arrived in the hostel, I was quickly told by my hostel mates that Alex, the police, are the enemy. And I thought, what are they talking about? You know, the police that I had known seemed to be okay. But they said, no, watch out for the police. They are the number one enemy. And slowly it dawned on me, I think it was the first week when I saw an arrest being done by this policeman, and how he cuffed this guy, ran ahead and boxed him and strangled him and dragged him away. I thought, my God. And I heard constant rumours and whispers of police brutality in police cells. And even then, I couldn't quite grasp that or realise that it was true until it happened to me when I was 16. I was taken to Brixton Police Station after a party. I was beaten up in a police van. I had a policeman's boot on my neck. I saw a couple of my friends, their locks being torn out of their scalp. I saw the blood running down on the floor of the police van. We was chucked into the police cell in Brixton Police Station, beaten up again. And the strange thing was, even though my older friends were charged, because I was 16, they felt, oh, it's not worth the trouble, so they just kicked me out.
That's amazing.
Just kicked me out of the back door of Brixton Police Station. I wasn't allowed to go out the front.
So as a 16-year-old, what were you getting up to? How were you living on the streets, so to speak?
I was hustling. I was out of school. I was meant to stay home in a hostel to have some kind of tutorials with lecturers and so on, but the vibe and music of the streets enticed me, you could say. And I was hustling here and there, selling the odd little bag of herb and this and that. And it seemed like one out of every other guy was doing that anyway. And I cannot believe that was only 3.5 million unemployed at the time, because when I was 16, 17, 80, 90% of my friends were on the Youth Opportunities Programme. And from what I saw of it, it was where employers would take advantage of young guys like myself and have us on their books for 6 months. And this is all government money. And so you'd only get about £2-3 more than unemployment benefit. But you had to spend that £2-3 for travel expenses. So really, it was just a ploy of trying to undercut the unemployment figures. Because after 6 months, after this course finished, you were never given a full employment.
What was the housing conditions in Brixton like at the time? What sort of places were you living in and your friends living in?
I was living in a hostel. But it really dawned on me when I visited friends that they had damp, they had this, they had so many problems with their housing. Not just that, but when I walked around the streets, there were so many broken down properties, boarded up properties, places where squatters would reside. And I guess you kind of become a bit blasé to it, because it's so much part of your everyday existence that you're not quite saying, oh, look at that, there's a squatter, squatters living at this address. It wouldn't even come across your mind to wait, stop, and just kind of let that sink in. It was so much part of your everyday environment that you just passed it away.
Were you knocking around with a group of friends you gradually made in Brixton? Was like a group of you?
Yeah.
supporting each other, so to speak?
Yeah, we were. I remember when I was 16, 17, that when I used to get my my benefit money or whatever money the social workers gave me, everyone would, all my friends would come around and I'd treat them to going down to the front line and buying a £2 draw of herb or something to celebrate that. And older friends of mine who got unemployment benefit, they do the same thing. And obviously we love reggae music, strongly influenced by anything coming from Jamaica. And people often forget the militancy of the lyrics of DJs like Brigadier Jerry, artists obviously like Bob Marley and the Wailers, Burning Spear, guys like that. And they really had a political influence on us in a really phenomenal way.
I mean, when you were growing up, would you say that the only politics you were exposed to was coming through the music rather than the more traditional?
Definitely, because we rejected what we was taught at history in schools, Henry VIII, we just wasn't interested in that. But when you're hearing a record by an artist like Burning Spear and he's chanting Christopher Columbus is a damn blasted liar, you think, wow. And then that would make you want to investigate further. And so out would come all the books.
What about the whole music scene generally? Because I get the impression it plays quite an important part in that period in Brixton.
It was thriving. I mean, it was fantastic for me coming from the Surrey countryside into this maelstrom of roots rock reggae that I never really experienced before. And on a Friday night, for instance, if you had nowhere to go, you just walk a couple of streets and everyone used to say, listen out for the bass line. You listen out for the bass line and hey, presto, there's a rocking blues party going on. And you pay your £1 entry fee. Sometimes we would go to the red phone boxes and try and break it open for the 2p's and say to the doorman, here's my entrance. And he'll count every single 2p piece before he let you through. And baseline would just assault your ears. And the kitchen was a makeshift bar. And they would serve drinks like Tennent's and Special Brew, and for ladies it was Pink Lady and Can I and other ladies' drinks of the day. And we would rock away, dance away, and if you was lucky enough to dance with a lady for the night, then you would go home about 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning thinking, yeah, great time.
Was there a reason why this, I suppose you could describe as a do-it-yourself music scene, evolved?
Yeah, I guess there were, because my father's generation say that when they first arrived in Brixton in the 50s, they wanted to go uptown to the clubs in the West End, but more often than not, they were refused entry. And so they started to import their own entertainment, like, mimicking the sound systems of Kingston, Jamaica, of the likes of Coxon, Dodd and King Tubby and great people like that. And so they started to do that in Brixton. And so they started to have radiogram parties at first before the sound systems emerged. And they would have their own entertainment, their own bars. And it was particularly on the Routon Road frontline of Brixton, drinking clubs, gambling clubs, and so on.
Were there any record shops you remember that you would say were pivotal, that were gathering places for people where you used to hang out, so to speak?
Oh, yeah. I used to always go to the Safana B record shop that was on the junction of Colaba Lane and Atlantic Road. And there was Desmond's Hip City that were for maybe my father's generation, where they can get their Blue Beat and Scar. In the market, there was a General Penitentiary record shop where you could get the same dancehall music from Jamaica. I mean, music was thriving. People don't really realise that because these record stores weren't affiliated with any record collect numbers or figures that used to compile the charts. I mean, the likes of Carole Thompson and Janet Kay, they sold 70,000 to 80,000 of their singles, but they weren't recognised in the charts. It's only until City Games really made the breakthrough. But before that, reggae was set in huge numbers.
What's the relationship between, should we talk about reggae and Rastafarianism, and perhaps some of the older members of the communities who might have been more Christian?
It was tense.
Right.
And a lot of my friends were kicked out of their homes because they started to grow locks. They started to debate Christianity and Haile Selassie and all that. It was very tense. A generation, it was a lot of tension there and lots of arguments happened and lots of young people had to find new digs because of that. It was a real struggle. It's not really recorded, really, but it really was. I remember visiting friends and it was especially my friends who were growing locks, and it was very difficult for them in their home lives.
What was the relationship like with different parts of the community, the Irish, the English, and various other people who were there? Or the squatters, perhaps?
Well, moving to Brixton, I never really felt any racism. I remember my father telling me that his first friends were Irish people because they were the first white people to offer him digs. And I remember, I'll never forget what one Irish boarding madam told him. He said, "I'm glad you guys are coming over because we will stop getting it in the neck." Mm. Now you guys are getting it in the neck. But it was civil. It was respectful. Sometimes we would drink together in pubs, play pool together, and so on. And it was mostly white guys who were in the squats, and we got on with them, and they loved the weed just as much as we did, so we thought they were cool.
So, one of the things that's interesting is that it's a community that's got an economic problem, in a sense,
yeah.
If you see what I mean. It's a fey poor community. You've got the Irish. There used to be the famous sign, you know, no yeah. dogs, no Irish, no black. So that you've got those. And Facebook says economic. Most of the people there are suffering economically. Was the police's attitudes towards the white squatters different to their response to you? Or were they equally...
From what I understand and what I was told, I never really witnessed it. But I did hear incidents of the police sometimes just on a whim going into squats and bashing everybody's heads in. And then they have a laugh about it and maybe leave them alone for another 2 weeks and then return and bash their heads in again. And so they got it in their neck as well, just as much as we did.
So to go back to the thing, would you say there was a slight split between the younger and the older generation?
Definitely, because when we were saying to our parents that this is what the police are doing to us, they could not quite believe it. And that caused tension as well and it split families apart. And there was this Christian thing, there's this Rasta thing, and they kind of, in general, believed the police more than what we did until the police started to break down doors and hunt for the sons of first-generation West Indians. And they saw the violence at first hand. They started to swing to our way.
So they gradually came on behind you and supported you?
Yeah, I believe so. Maybe not everybody, but in general, I believe that happened, yeah.
Right, so we've got Brixton, you've got a daily harassment from the police and that sort of thing. Can I just ask you what impact the New Cross Fire had?
It scared us, because we're never sure what really happened, but with a possibility...
You still don't know, do you?
We still don't know. With a possibility that it was started by a National Front agitator, that really scared us, because... We've all been there at that kind of situation in a packed-out blues party, packed downstairs, packed upstairs. And we think, you know, this is the way we lived our lives on Friday nights and Saturday nights. And so we all had sympathy and we all could relate because we felt, are we going to be a target next? Could it happen in Brixton? And that kind of scared us. And we was thinking, so this is what they're going to do to us now. And from where we stood, the police investigation was never thorough. And it seemed not to be even acknowledged by the authorities in control at the time. There was no letter from no mayor, there's no message from no queen, no messages or sympathy from any politician, nothing. So we felt isolated. And sometimes many of the questions asked is, did you feel British or West Indian at the time, even though many of us were born here? And definitely at that point, we felt West Indian and outsiders and hated.
Right. Did the NF have any impact in Brixton at all? I mean, the rhetoric's there, but did they have any real presence there?
Not that I'm aware of. Now and again, you might see the odd NF in a lift, especially if you go down to Camberwell Way, or the Haygate Estate, or areas like that. But within Brixton itself, SW9, SW2, very, no, I'm not aware of any kind of movement or any kind of anything written on the walls there.
Right, can I ask you to cast your mind back now, 30 years, to the first Brixton riot? What were you doing just before it? How did you hear about it?
I have to go back to the February of that year, 1981, where the police launched Operation Swamp. and it was getting ridiculous. We was getting stopped 2 or 3 times a day, and people disappeared for hours and then came back with bruises all over their faces and so on. And then it was a Friday night. I think it was April the 9th or the 10th. And we was in a pub in Brixton Hill, me and about 7 or 8 friends. We were shooting pool for money, I don't know, about 20p or 10p or a game or something like that. And then around about 7, 8 o'clock, somebody ran in, another young black guy, and he shouted out with lots of excitement that the police had stabbed a sufferer. In other words, one of us, a sufferer. That's the term we used to use. Mm.
That's an interesting term, that, isn't it?
Yeah, a sufferer. We was all sufferers.
Yeah.
And so we thought, what, what? The police had stabbed somebody? And he said, yeah, right on the front line itself. The police had actually, in broad daylight, stabbed a sufferer. And because of our perception of the police and how we felt about them, because they were the enemy, we didn't even question his term, his, you know, his account at all. And so this rumour went around Brixton like wildfire, and we stayed up the whole night, talked about it, what's going to happen the next day, people saying bring murder to the police, take them on. Lots of people were saying that. The Russers, in fact, were trying to call us down. I remember there was a few Russers that very night trying to, you know, calm down, youths, they would say, calm down, you know. And yeah, we were smoking weed and this and that, just but I guess when he was young, and because of the hatred we felt, we wanted to react against something. We wanted to confront them. And so I don't think, I didn't go to bed that night. And so we went off en masse, my group of friends, down Brixton Hill, early in the morning, about 8:45, just to wait, to react to something. And there was an increased presence of sufferers on the streets that morning. Usually you wouldn't see sufferers until the afternoon or the evening.
But they were still in bed.
Yeah, from the previous night's entertainment, yeah. Usually. Blues parties or whatever, or sound system dance. But they were actually en masse in Brixton from very early. And we were just crowding around the record shops. We'd done a roaring trade, by the way, on that morning. And just waiting to react to something. And there's also increased members of the police. They're walking in, instead of walking in twos, they're walking in threes and fours, sometimes five. And they obliged around about just after one. They stopped a taxi driver on Atlantic Road or Routon Road or the junction between the two. And then this scuffle happened. Resistance happened. Everyone said, leave him alone, leave him alone. And he was being tugged, this guy who police were trying to arrest, and the police were trying to exert their authority. And then the authority was really questioned, not just by words, but by physical means. And so within a few minutes, this police van, and I'm sure it was an SVG van, came into view, screeched up. And I think they really felt there's a van in the area now, everyone's going to disperse. But the opposite happened. Everyone surrounded that police van like it was a magnet. And it was quite unbelievable to see this police van being rocked side by side and to see the faces of the policemen inside. They could not quite believe what was happening to them. And they were powerless, totally powerless. And just rocked from side to side, and then it just smashed down, and then the windows on the van were starting to get kicked in. And then all hell broke loose. In the next moments after that, I heard sirens from all over the place. The police eventually tried to get out of the van. They were chased. And they, I think, ran back to the station, from my memory. And then many more vans came into the area. We decided to go up the Routon Road because we wanted to defend Routon Road. And then that's where the battle started. That is where the battle... And what we did, to get more ammunition, we kicked down... on Routon Road and Mile Road, there were low walls fronting houses. We kicked all those down for ammunition to throw at the police. And then later on in the afternoon, Molotov cocktails appeared. We threw those. At first, I wasn't even quite aware what they were. Or, you know, they just smelt really weird. And so they were thrown into the police ranks, and they were holding dustbin lids and anything they could. I remember a bus coming down from the Hernhill end of Routon Road, and the bus driver stopped. See what's going on. And he said to his passengers, I think you better get off now. And it was taken over. by a sufferer. He tried to drive it into the police ranks, but one of the policemen picked up a brick and threw it at the windscreen on his bus, and the bus careered into somebody's front garden. It was crazy but exhilarating. You were scared but exhilarated to actually see the police retreat, because for so long, talking personally, we were fearful of the police. For the 4 years from 14 to 18, it's like an everyday thing. You see the police, you sometimes cower, you sometimes get ready to run. You look over your shoulder when you're walking late at night in Brixton from a blues party or whatever. You was always ready to run. But it seemed the tables had turned, like in Bob Marley's record, the tables had turned in Slave Master. It was now them running away from us. And I cannot describe how powerful that felt.
Were more people joining in as it went on?
Oh, yeah.
And they were, how was it, I mean, if you weren't in the immediate area, I assume there was a noise and everything. Was there a sort of grapevine that was buzzing?
I think because of the buzz that happened on a Friday night.
Right.
Because this swept around Brixton like wildfire. I'm sure every estate got to hear what happened on a Friday evening when there was a skirmish with the police and the stabbed sufferer. Everyone got to hear about that. So people felt, sufferers felt, something will happen in Brixton on a Saturday. They weren't quite sure what, but something will quite happen. And when the looting started in the early afternoon on Saturday, and so there were like two fronts. There was a crowd of us fighting the police, and also another crowd fighting over new shoes and jewellery in Brixton High Street.
And, well, I mean, did white people join in?
Yeah, I saw a few white people joining. And loot a few clothes and so on.
And how long did this go on for?
It went on to, it really got bad around 6, 7, 8 o'clock when we felt we wanted to set fire to the properties, the public houses that had denied us entry. So we targeted those properties and it went up in flames. That was quite an unbelievable sight also to see these buildings just crumble. And just set a light and lighten up the night sky. It was a really incredible feeling. And then the fire engines, later on, I think it was about 11 or 12, because even though the police had called for reinforcements, they still had no control of the situation, no control whatsoever, because we would attack them on the fringes and so on. And they were obviously not used to this kind of uprising, not at all.
Mass resistance,
they,
basically.
They didn't know what to do. We knew the streets better than they did. We attacked them in alleyways. We lured them into traps, all this kind of thing. And this is just off the cuff. No one was a central organizer or leader. None of that happened at all. So I don't know where these rumours or say-sos come from, but that did not happen.
It was a spontaneous response by the community to the continual harassment over years of harassment, which
we wanted to get at the police, and so we used our local knowledge to get at the police.
And to take control of your area, in a sense.
And take control of mainly Brixton Road, Mile Road, Brixton High Street, Mile Road and Routon Road.
I mean, in the adrenaline rush and the exhilaration and the fear, how controlled was the looting in the sense that were there certain places that people said, oh, leave that alone, that's so-and-so? Or, as I say, in the exhilaration, did a lot of that go by?
In the exhilaration, a lot of it did go by, but there was still a couple of shots. A popular clothes shop, I remember, on the Atlantic Road, I believe, that was left untouched. And so even in the madness, people had respect for certain properties rather than others.
And did you get help from the community? Perhaps not necessarily people who were there throwing the stuff, but people who were prepared to support you, provide you with food? And
yes, that happened, especially on Routon Road and Mile Road, where sometimes we would disappear into people's houses. They'd let us in and we would the lights would be turned off. And when the police came up the road looking for us, we'd all pour out all of a sudden and start the brick throwing again. And they didn't quite know how to deal with that. But some of those houses that offered a shelter suffered later on because they were ransacked in the week afterwards.
But would you say it was primarily young people who were involved in it? I mean, I suppose largely because they can run and all this stuff faster than the older people. But
yeah, 16 to 30, I would say.
The Brixton riot, had a big impact both on your personal life and the community. Can I ask you to talk about it, the impact it had on you personally to begin with?
Well, on a Saturday night, I was chased by the police up around Brixton Water Lane. I went up. I tried to get up to Tolls Hill because there's an estate there where I felt I could escape into. And so I was in a forecourt of this estate, and I heard the police behind me still chasing me. So I jumped in this garbage bin to escape. And they hunted around the estate looking for me, and they couldn't find me after a while. And I finally got back to my hostel. And I was a DJ at the time. And I used to write lyrics on a daily basis. And I wanted to write a lyrics about what happened to me on that night. And so you want to hear the lyrics?
Indeed we do, yes.
It goes something like this. Uprising, it's a uprising. Uprising, it's a uprising. Uprising, it's a uprising. We're sick and tired of the ghetto holes in on the jams, hustler and police beating. We have no work and we have no shilling. We can't take no more of this suffering. You better send for the army and the God. We're gonna mash up and burn down the Scotland Yard. Come listen, people, to the Brixton Bard. Police officer, you better put up your guard, Guan. Uprising, it's a uprising. Uprising, it's a uprising. Uprising, it's a uprising. We get up in the morning at 10:30. Forward down the hill to the Brixton City. Sight Babylon, them start attack we. And we start fling stone and masonry. Police get a firebomb in them belly. And the temperature raised by another degree. While you get a soldier, start a looting spree. Come listen to the words of a yardman, Harry Guan. Uprising, it's a uprising. Holy pa police car, them still burning. Holy pa building, them still smoking. Yardman, I be on the mic, me there a chanting Guan. Uprising, it's a uprising. Uprising, it's a uprising. Uprising, it's a uprising. So that was my trade. And I was arrested a few weeks after the riots. And I was sentenced to 7 months prison for causing an affray. And in prison, I met an elder Rasta guy, and he encouraged me to write and to read as much as I could. And my lyrics turn into short stories. My short stories eventually turn into novels. And so here I am talking to you, 7 novels in now, and a play as well, and a one-man theatrical show that I've just come off the back of.
I mean, when you started, would I be right in thinking you were more interested in the music, and sound systems and all that?
Yeah, definitely.
And you go to prison. What did you read in prison or that made you think, hold on, there's something here for me?
I remember reading C.L.R. James, The Black Jacobins, at a pivotal moment for me, reading that book and the struggle for independence in that country. I was reading Richard Wright, Native Son, all these books related to me, I felt. I was reading Chester Himes. I was reading Ralph Ellison. Lots of black writers from the New York Renaissance, James Baldwin as well. Also, guys like Steinbeck, he had a really big impact on me because even though he's writing about the Dust Bowl of America, I felt that what he's writing about related to me also, about, you know, persecution of working class. And so really what happened to me in the riots, I'm not sure if I was aware of it at the time, but I was politicized from that moment. I guess the moment that I was arrested and beaten up in a police cell, I was politicized from that moment.
Right, so you get out of prison. You go back to Brixton. You study in Brixton Library, did you?
Yes, I did. And because I had no money to buy any books. And so, you know, they're closing libraries now. Thank God we didn't close Brixton Library back then, because that was my school, if you like. That was where I studied. That is where I read history. That's where I read the classics. That's where I read whatever books I could lay my hands on. Dickens a lot. I even read the Greek histories.
So this is quite interesting, because one of the things that your comments brought up, that the early working class movement in this country thought education was very important. In the East End, Jewish people used Whitechapel Library to educate themselves. You seem to be going through a similar process. How important is education,
vital.
Self-education as well?
Vital for me, because the school system never suited me. I don't believe, because I was always labelled as maladjusted, always labelled as unteachable, always labelled as someone bitter and angry and so on. And so I had to find education my own way. But through education, I learned about my own self and my own people's history, which was very important because that wasn't taught to me at school either. I wasn't taught that in Africa they had great civilizations and subjects like that. I mean, I left the children's home thinking that Tarzan was a hero and that he was right to beat up all these so-called savages in a jungle. That was my mentality when I left the children's home and went to Brixton. And so the Russes had a lot of influence on me about self-belief, self-worth, and take my place in society, they would always say. You know, they always said to me I could contribute so much more if I disbelieved it.
But when you got out of prison and went back to Brixton, what was the sort of feel in Brixton? Were people afraid of retaliation for what had happened?
Yeah, there was a lot of fear, retaliation, and for a long while, even after the Scarman inquiry, the police never changed in their attitude towards us. In fact, all they did was make sure that they had better shields and better helmets. And so it wasn't until the Lawrence inquiry that they finally realised they had to change their attitudes and get rid of this racism that had been filtering through the police force on who knows when.
Perhaps we could talk about your books now. I mean, how did you decide you were going to become a writer, if you see what I mean? It's quite a big step forward, isn't it?
Yeah. I guess personal experiences. And with my love of reading that I developed in the Brixton Library, I used to go to bookshops and think, well, where's the story about me or people like me? And even though we had Lynton Kwesi Johnson, you know, famous poet, there wasn't much out there, not in the bookshops around where I lived or uptown. You know, where were our lives recorded? And I always felt our lives are just as much important as anybody else's, you know? So I felt, okay, then maybe the likes of me should try and write a book. So that's where the general idea came from, because I felt that misrepresentation, that lack, you know, there's our lives not being recorded. Like other lives were. Other lives seemed to be more important than our lives, you know?
Right, I suppose...
I just wanted to redress the balance a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, after you left jail, how did you survive? And you're writing books, but how much of a struggle was it to get published?
I left jail and I trained. I managed to get on a course to learn about engineering. I did that. I was still writing poetry. Lots of poetry, lots of lyrics for a long while. I didn't write a book until the early 90s. I think it was 1993, 1994. But before that, I was performing as a performance poet in bars and places like that, or gatherings. And I was encouraged by the audience to, Alex, you know, you could do something bigger and better than this. You know, you could write a whole novel. And at first, I did not have that belief. But again, the Russes said, you know, you should really think about it. You know, you should write a story. Believe in yourself. You know, you got a lot of story to give. You got a story to tell. So tell it. And with their encouragement, I started my tentative steps trying to write a book. And I knew nothing about the publishing industry. So my first draft was written in biro. And I remember going up to one of these big top literary agencies with my handwritten manuscript that had spliff burns in it, had jam on it, chocolate stains. And I felt all writers were almost millionaires. So I felt that I'm going to walk out of this office with a big fat contract in my pocket and I could treat all my friends to BMWs. But it wasn't quite so the case. I was rejected. I sent off my manuscript something like 25 times. I had to learn to type.
This is Brixton Rock.
Rock. I had to learn to type. I had to learn not to commit spelling mistakes and all that. I even took a night class at a local night college to brush up my English. But I was determined because I felt that our lives were important.
And they were not being recorded.
And not being recorded. So I kept at it. I think because I was so naive to the whole industry, I kept on. I thought, what are they talking about? That is not publishable. What are they talking about? And so I kept on. And finally, I was from starting Ricks and Rock in 1993, it was finally published in 1999.
It's a long time.
Yeah, 6 years. But I was determined to do that. And it's quite incredible now that I'm touring different countries, my books are translated into different languages. And here I am sitting before you, what, 12 years after my first book. Well, I still sometimes have to pinch myself.
I was going to say, I suppose Brixton Rock and East of Acre Lane are the two books you've written that relate to what we're talking about.
Yeah.
You must get bored of people asking you this question, but how autobiographical are these books?
50%. There's some real incidents that happen in a book that happened to me or my friends. So 50, 60%, I would say.
One of the things you wanted to do with these books was to record the street language.
Yeah, definitely.
How did you go about doing that? And how did you find publishers responded to that? Because I know somebody like James Kelman, who does a similar sort of things with Glaswegian dialect. You know, most of the certainly the chattering classes and the literati aren't too keen on.
Well, that was the most. That was the reason given by many of these 25 publishers why they could not possibly publish this. But Irvin Welsh, he published Trainspotting, and I thought, well, that's difficult for me, but I can enjoy that book. I can get, you know, because once you have a text that is full of, what do you call it, colloquisms or accents or whatever, you get a feel of the character that informs the character, and you can feel the character. I felt I'd be doing a disservice if I had my characters in Brixton at 16, 17, 18 talking in the Queen's English. This would not be right. I'd be laughed at by my friends. So I had to at least attempt to try and arrange their accent phonetically. I at least had to do that, you know, because otherwise the book wouldn't be real if I didn't do so.
The other thing is, you talked about John Steinbeck and the Jodes. Now, one of the things interesting about these books is they have far wider appeal than just if you're stuck in Brixton. That they have, like the Jodes, they touch upon almost a universal theme, which is to do with poverty, depression. With the Jodes, it was traveling to California, the Garden of Eden, and all this sort of stuff. I mean, what do you think is the root cause of all these issues, if you see what I'm getting at?
Oh,
is it economic? Or I know it's a bit of a heavy question to ask.
Obviously, it's economic. Obviously, those who have the power and the money will do almost anything to keep it. Obviously, we're not being told the whole truth about certain events in world history and why people are so poor, why people are so rich. I mean, let's look at the current crisis about this deficit, and there's no other way to address this deficit. Now, it's quite clear that there is other ways. Like, for instance, some of these multinationals, they set up their companies registered in islands like the Grand Cayman, Turks and Caicos. I mean, this is a fact. There are more companies, global companies, registered in the Turks and Caicos than there are actual people living there. And so if these governments were not so cowardly and went after the taxes that are meant to be paid in this country, the deficit could be wiped out at a stroke. So don't tell me that there's no other way of addressing deficit of keeping poor people poor and that you can't build schools and you can't do this and that. You can. We're always being lied to. We've been lied to back in 81. Before 81, people are kept poor by reasons of so-called elite keeping their power, keeping their money, and keeping our servitude.
What do you think came out of the riots? I mean, they were important. There are three riots. I mean, your experience is mainly the first one, but there were three riots. What came out of it for Brixton?
What came out of it was good that at last we had some kind of voice. A short time after the first uprising in 81, we had the first newspaper, The Voice, that was
Which
published.
Very important.
Politicians emerged, people like Paul Boateng, who talked at length about Brixton. I remember his big afro on Newsnight on a programme after the first Brixton uprising. We had a voice through people like him. And so we was able to exert our feelings, our politics, through people like him, even though I believe that he kind of let us down in later years when he got in power. But at least there were the first soundings of the way we felt and the way we felt marginalised, because let's not forget, the first uprising was reported all over the world. It greatly embarrassed the government. And I don't think in the future no government can really ignore the feelings of a disaffected community, because it will turn up and kick them in the arse.
And in terms of the community, despite the fear they must have felt, you know, the possible repression coming in after it, did it leave a more self-confident community?
Self-confident. The problems remain for many. Even now, they still remain. But at least we knew that we had some kind of voice. because the policing did not improve immediately afterwards, nor did the housing, nor did the unemployment problems. They remain, but at least we felt they now had to pay attention to us, and they will pay attention to us in the future if they try to ignore us again.
Looking back on your life from this point of view, if you could imagine giving some advice to the young Alex at 18, what would you say, and would he have taken it?
Oh, dear. What would I say to the young Alex? I would say to him, know your history. Believe in what you can do. Believe in your potential. Believe that you can be anything. That's what I would tell him. And I guess that was a trouble of back then, that before I was politicised, I never believed I could do anything. But that's what a suppressed regime does to you. It makes you believe that you're not capable of anything. I think that's a real tragedy of any kind of community that's been repressed, because you believe there is no hope.
Well, you see, you've proved that completely wrong, because, I mean, perhaps you could talk about not just the books I've mentioned, the Easter Egg Lane and Brixton Rock, but tell us all the things you've done since you got out of prison and what you're planning in the future, which shows how much hope there is for the young Alexes of today.
Well, I'm involved in screenwriting. We're adapting Easter Egg Lane, one of my novels that has the backdrop of the Brixton riots. I developed a one-man show that I'm touring this summer. I'm involved with teaching creative writing in schools, universities, prisons, other organisations. And believe it or not, I was the guest speaker at a policeman's ball in West Yorkshire a few years ago, which was a really strange invitation, but I took it up.
You got awarded the MBE?
Got awarded the MBE in 2008 for my services to literature and my work in prisons and schools and other organisations. And I intend to write a lot more books, a lot more plays, a lot more essays. I'm not going to stop, because I still feel that working class are not really represented in literature, plays, theatre, what have you.
And what are you actually working upon at the moment?
At the moment, I'm working on a children's fantasy. New ground for me, but I feel that with children's fiction, children of colour are not really represented in a great way. I mean, nothing against the books of J.K. Rowling or the great books of the past like Peter Pan or whatever, or the great stories that we have come accustomed to like Star Wars. But when I look at these films and stories, there's not many black people involved who are black children involved who are saving the world. So I just want to address that little balance with my little book.
Could you, if you go back to Brixton today, can you recognise the Brixton of your youth?
It's strange for me, because when I was 16, I walked down Brixton Hill. I recognised all the people down there, the second-hand bookshops, the record stores. All that's changed. All that's changed. And now I go to the front line now, and I see a sushi bar. I see a lounge bar. I see an art gallery. And it's more of a pleasant place to visit, actually, I believe. And it attracts all comers, really. And it's much more multinational. It's not just the West Indian community. You've got a strong Portuguese community, a North African community, Eastern European community. I think that's all great. It's great for me that when my kids had their birthday parties when they're 9, 10, 11, they would invite children from parents who came from all over the world. And to me, that's a great thing. You know, to see that interaction, because that never happened in my day.
So, I mean, you have a positive approach to the world.
Yeah, I do.
Would you sort of say?
Yeah, I do. And this is why I believe things will be changed in the future, because those children will grow up not seeing racism, not seeing difference. So that's the positive thing I see from the communities like Brixton now.
I mean, could the Brixton riots ever happen again? Not necessarily in Brixton, but are the conditions still around today?
Yes, they are. If this present government keeps on ignoring the plight of so many young people, because I want to repeat this, between the ages of 16 and 24, almost a million are unemployed. And for the government to say that is just regrettable, they're stirring up a hornet's nest. They really are. They cannot, as I said before, they cannot just ignore community like that and think they're going to get away with it. No. They're going to be kicked on the arse if they do not address that. That should be their number one priority. You know, all this talk about big society, does it give young people work? No. That should be the number one priority. Not David Cameron blabbing on about big society, no. The most important, I think, aspect of work that he's got to do, government's got to do, is trying to address his youth unemployment problem.
One of the things is that obviously amongst your group of friends when you were young, the music was something that held you completely together.
Yeah.
Has that been fragmented in the 30 years? Do you know what I mean? There was so much like you all shared the same music, the same blues parties. Do you know what I mean? Has that, with the new technology and everything, has that sort of, I don't know, community within a community been fragmented?
The way music is listened to now is not as communal as it was for me and my friends. Like when we went to the dance halls in Brixton Town Hall, for example, and we heard Burning Spear sing Christopher Columbus's and Jam Blasted Liar, we all felt that moment of that new song or whatever new song it was, and we all felt politicized by it. Now, when young people are just listening to their iPods and personal music, whatever, they don't have that same communal feel as we did, I believe. Yeah. And so there is a difference to the way they receive music from the way we receive music. So I kind of suggest that maybe because of that, they're not as politicized as we were, where we shared a big moment when we heard new music from Jamaica, and we would go home and discuss what music we listen to. These days, I think it's kind of rare for young people to actually discuss the meaning of lyrics and this and that. We would debate into the night, into the morning about certain music, and not just reggae. We would also debate Van Morrison. We'd also debate the White Album or the Beatles or the Grateful Dead, because all that, especially if you use a DJ of a sound system, all that would inform your lyrics, and you try to pepper it with really great lines of fantastic songs, because it was a communal experience listening to music. If someone brought in a Grateful Dead album, for instance, we'd all listen, right, the dreads included, whatever, and we'd have a strong debate about it. But now, because music is listened to so personally, it doesn't happen so much.
The more traditional, I'm thinking of the US music, like blues, Robert Johnson, Muddy Waters. Mm-hmm. Did they have any impact at all?
Not really.
Probably not, no.
No, I guess that was way before our... maybe not Muddy Waters, but Robert Johnson certainly, he was, what, 20s, 30s?
Yeah.
We did listen to a lot of Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, especially... What's going on? Definitely, we listened to that, we debated the Vietnam War and other wars, and because of that album, we listened to a lot of early Cox and Dodd recordings from Jamaica, late 50s, early 60s, and we particularly played those kind of records in the blues parties that we had. R&B, doo-wop, listen to all of those, because our parents are listening to those as well.
What about relationships with the police? Has that improved?
Better than they were, but there's work to be done on their side, I believe. I still think there are elements of the police force that are not appropriate for today's world, multicultural world that we live in London and elsewhere. And so it is. And in fact, I'm asked now to address police recruits about stop and search, about dealing with ethnic minorities and so on. And so I think where 30 years ago you was deemed as a traitor for joining the police, now I believe that if you don't join the police, it's always going to be a them and us situation. And so I do suggest that many of us maybe should think of a career in the police force. And I think it'd be wrong for us to see those people as traitors, because it does need to be changed. It does need to reflect the community that it polices.
What about the housing situation in Brixton? Is that getting better, or is it getting a bit gentrified so that the local community
gentrified
can't afford it?
It's one of the banes of my life that the number of schools that my peers went to have all been bulldozed, and now you've got expensive gated properties there. One example is Dick Shepherd School on Tulse Hill. That's been bulldozed, and now you've got this big block of flats, gentrified block of flats, gated communities that working class people can never hope to afford. So it's a crying shame that this kind of thing is going on, not just in Brixton, but other areas of London. It seems like the working class are being slowly pushed out to the margins. And soon, because of the new laws regarding housing benefit, are we going to be a city like Paris, where on the fringe it's going to be the working class, and in the middle you've got the middle class?
So as the people are pushed out, and this has happened in lots of areas of London, what's going to happen to the memories? As the people move out, their living history moves out with them. How are the memories of that area going to be maintained?
We have to fight to preserve the memories and the people who lived there. And so there's a group of people, including the Black Culture Archives, who are trying to preserve that memory by having a museum, an art place, where old histories can be recorded, where you could actually see living history of films and recordings, and a place of significance where people can visit and see who lived in Brixton, what it was like to live in Brixton in the time of not just the early 1980s, but the early 1950s also, photographic stills, and the rest of it, because I think it's important that you record places of interest like Brixton. I mean, Brixton's world-renowned. I have family in America who want to come to Brixton just to explore it from a tourist point of view, which I think is bizarre, but there you go. And so we do need centres like that to remind people of what it meant for people like myself and my father's generation to actually live there.
But that's actually quite interesting. The fact, I mean, somehow Brixton has branded itself on the world. If people want to cut, I mean, I would suggest it was the riots that were part of that, and the dynamism of the music and the subcultures were gone. It's quite an amazing achievement, actually, if you think about it.
I think so. I mean, even now it is walking tours. So if you're interested in a walking tour, in fact, I was asked to narrate one walking tour myself. And so, I'm so much surprised when I go to places like Howard in Washington, D.C., and I know all about Brixton. And I go to the Caribbean and I know all about Brixton. It's quite reassuring for me that, you know, our lives were important. Our lives did mean something. The area did mean, you know, people did read about what was happening in Brixton.
And what's happened to all your friends? I mean, I'm quite curious. I mean, go back to 30 years ago, you know, you're 18. What do you think's happened to all the people who were out in the streets doing their thing, so to speak?
The same diversity of life. Some made a real go of things, went back to school or college, whatever, and graduated with degrees, and some of them are running businesses. Some of them are still smoking away. Some of them, a few, are in and out of prison. And so it varies. But some people have really, from a very bad start, have done really well. And we should not forget that. And, you know, it's not just a few either. Many people have done really well. You know, and they were like me, had no hope, but they found some kind of strength, some kind of determination to better their lives. And they have done so. Some, I know teachers, I know all kinds of professional people who were throwing bricks alongside me.
But they were basically quite decent people.
Yeah.
Who had been pushed to the limit. I think this is quite an important point. People who just naturally responded, they weren't being agitated by external factors. They were just a group of people that said, enough is enough.
Yeah.
And we're beginning to see that in like, Egypt.
Yeah, and elsewhere.
And in this country again.
Yeah, well, I hope it comes to fruition in this country, because I hope people can believe that you don't have to accept the situation. You can do something about it.
Well, can you just talk a bit more about your new books?
Brixton Rock, that was published in 1999. Over the years, I've been asked, Alex, would there be a sequel? Well, I'm happy to say that there will be a sequel called Brent and Brown, and it's published by Arcadia Black Amber this coming June. It was about time that I addressed that story of a young mixed-race boy in early 1980s Brixton, doesn't know his family, and he encounters his mother, and then he's introduced to his half-sister, and they have this intense love affair. And it's only later on, after I wrote the book, that I started to get letters from people saying about GSA, genetic sexual attraction. And it's quite a phenomenon that I never quite understood, but it's very real. Because I've interviewed people and they said it's real to them and they cannot understand the attraction they have for their half-brother or half-sister. And so I've explored that in a new book. And also I've gone into... the main character's past in a children's home that I really wanted to address to really make people aware of what was going on in children's homes at the time in the mid-70s and so on.
So you've only just scratched your wide palette of books you can be writing about.
Yeah, definitely, because that's a story that needs to be told, the way children were treated. I mean, this country's always gone on about how other countries should treat their children, but this country has a lot to answer for also of how they treat their children.
Right, well, regretfully, we're running out of time. As I said previously, if you want to listen to this programme again or get any background information, please check out our website, loststeps.org. I'd also like to point out you can buy all of Alex's books at the bookshop where I work, which is Houseman's Bookshop, 5 Caledonian Road. Alex, do you have a website or anything? If people want to get in contact with you, can they get in contact with you at all?
They can through Facebook. I've always been asked to build a website, but that will come. I'm not that technologically minded, but it will be there. But for the time being, you can contact me on Alex Sweet or just Google me and send me a message on Facebook or something.
All right, well, that's fine. Perhaps we could end the programme with you reading from East of Acre Lane.
Okay, this is a scene from the Brixton Uprising, 1981. The windows of every shop that skirted the High Street, Atlantic Road and the adjacent streets had been smashed to oblivion. A middle-aged white lady ambled up Brixton Hill, holding a baby in her left arm while pushing a pram that held a new television. Sweet boys tried on clothes in deserted menswear shops as women fought over gold in erect jewellers. A suited man sat on a curb and burst into tears as his shop was emptied of all garments. Beside him, on a pavement, was a new pair of boxer shorts. 10 yards away was a headless tailor's dummy. Woolworths, situated in High Street, was not immune to the looter's lust. Food shelves became vacant and tills were pillaged. Stereo systems marched out of the store upon people's shoulders as shop assistants watched in dread. Armfuls of clothes disappeared in all directions as security staff cowered in back rooms. Inside Boots, the pharmacist locked himself into his back room as looters stocked up on cold remedies, face creams, toothpaste, soap, and anything else they could lay their hands on. Marketeers hastily boxed up their goods while hungry beggars raided butcher shops and a spicy chicken takeaway. A small boy, separated from his mother, picked up a melted policeman's helmet and tried it on for size. Bible thumpers jumped off their soapboxes and scattered while their cousins, the dune mongers, stood still in complete awe. Socialist Party activists abandoned their selling of newspapers and joined the looters. Empty shoeboxes littered the pavement on the High Street as all creeds swapped their footwear for something new. Groups of young men served themselves drinks in a Prince of Wales pub. A little black boy dressed in a Darth Vader t-shirt was filling his pockets with chocolate bars. Throwing away his old tatty jacket, a tramp pulled on a new one, tutting at the length of the sleeves. A teenager went by on his new roller skates. A white guy with 3 Tesco shopping baskets ran into a menswear shop. An elderly black gentleman walked casually towards Acre Lane, trying on different hats, while packs of youngsters, hearing of the uprising, poured into the district from all avenues. The encroaching dusk backdropped the numerous fires, especially in a George public house in Effra Parade, the building totally covered in flames that licked the air above the surrounding terrace houses. Passers-by looked up in awe as firemen battled to quell the fire's rage.
Thanks very much, Alex. That was great.
Thank you.